You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script. This is American Theater's podcast about all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weinert-Kent. I'm the senior editor at American Theater, and I'm here with...
Deep Tran, associate editor.
And Susie Evans. I'm the managing editor.
Great. Well, we have a great show today. We have an interview with Larissa Fasthorse, who was passing through town for the TCG conference. Or not the conference, excuse me.
Board
the TCG
meeting.
Board meeting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Funny story about that.
Yeah, and we wanted to sit down with her while she was here. And guess what? We had a snow day, an unplanned snow day. So we did it by Skype. Is that right?
Exactly. Well, Rob and I wanted to interview her, and then we were both stuck in Queens that day, so that didn't happen. But it's still a good conversation. She's a Native American playwright of Lakota descent, and she's from South Dakota, and she's a former ballerina.
She's based in the Bay Area now, is that right?
No, Santa Monica, California.
Oh, Santa Monica, okay.
Yeah.
She has a play, Landless, that just went up at the Ultra Theater Ensemble in Santa Rosa, so.
Yeah, and now it's in San Francisco at... American Conservatory Theater?
Oh, at their costume shop.
Yeah,
right,
the costume shop.
So she talked about that whole cool thing?
Yep.
That's really cool. ACT's built that new small theater in the Tenderloin, right? Is that where it is?
Yeah, it's like Tenderloin. It's kind of like the garage series at Steppenwolf. It's for small local companies
right.
to use rent-free. And
that's awesome.
Yeah. So awesome. Big theaters taking care of little theaters.
Is that part of their expansion, the ACT expansion they've been working on?
They also have a new space. That was a former... Was it a former porn theater, I think?
Yeah, I think so. I think that sounds right. We wrote about it a few months ago back.
In a moment, we'll go to the interview with Larissa. But we just want to talk about a few things that we're working on. Deep, there's an exciting thing happening in Colorado this weekend and next, right?
Yes. For anyone who lives in Denver this weekend, the 14th to the 15th, if you want to have an atypical Valentine's Day, then you can go to the Colorado New Play Summit. It's hosted by Denver Center Theater Company. And they do four readings. This year, the readings include a new play by Teresa Reback, by Tanya Saracho, Catherine Treshman. And this is the place where The Whale by Samuel D. Hunter first got its workshop and world premiere, and also Matthew Lopez's The Legend of Georgia McBride, which is going to be at MCC Theater in New York City next season. And so they do a lot of great work, and it's going to be play readings plus two world premieres.
I don't even know if they've done The Whale there.
That's where it world premiered.
Really? Okay. Before playwrights?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's where it world premiered.
That actually rings a bell. You're right.
We ran an article about it way back when. That's how I remembered.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. By the time it got to playwrights, it was already on a radar, and we published it by the time. I don't know.
Yeah, but we publish things. I guess it has to have had one production before we publish it.
Right. Yeah, that's
something like Taylor Max here, which we published, had a production at Magic.
Yeah,
and
we tend to. There are cases you can point to where we published a play that did not have a production, but that's very rare.
We published a lot of plays that are coming to playwrights next season. Here, The Christians.
All about playwrights, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
I think we're safe to announce right now that our next play in our April issue will be not a playwright's one. It'll be the Public Theater. It's a Young Gene Lee's Straight White Men, who we did a big piece about Young Gene You Should Check Out by Eliza. So we're jumping all over the place here. New Play Summit also has another weekend next weekend, right?
Yeah, it's a two-weekend thing. Usually it's just one weekend, but this year, this is the 10th year they're doing the New Play Summit, and so they expand it to two. And
wow.
Besides the new play readings and world premieres, one by James Still, the other by Eric Schmiedel.
Right.
Who, I'm not sure if I said his last
Schmiedel,
name.
Maybe, I'm not sure.
Jewish?
Yeah, sure, but what's the play he's doing, do you know? Appoggiatura and...
Appoggiatura by James Still and Benediction by Eric Schmiedel.
Nice.
Sorry,
nice.
Eric, if I butchered your last name.
That's all right.
And there's also going to be, like, workshops led by Matthew Lopez and by Paula mm-hmm. Vogel. So it seems like it's going to be a fun weekend. I've always wanted to go, but haven't gotten around to it, so that's on my list of things to do in the future. So I recommend, if you're in the area, go do that.
Sounds good. Yeah, well, we'll keep an eye on the plays that start there because they seem to go places.
Yeah.
I am working on a story now. I'm not sure when it's going to be online because the story is still developing on the latest developments in the 99-seat plan debate in Los Angeles. For those who don't follow this, it's basically LA has had a version of an equity showcase code that's been in existence for roughly 30 years that's seen by many as seen by some as exploitive of actors because there's just a stipend. It's basically a kind of waiver, but with some protections. But what is this, what has happened is that there's this amazing theater scene, which I knew very well. I should say firsthand because I did work with them, so it's firsthand, secondhand. That was my hometown theater scene of small theaters that do plays within the 99-seat plan, dozens of them, and some of them scrappy storefronts, and others like, you know, almost quasi midsize, like the Fountain Theater or the Odyssey Theater. But they work under a plan which does not mandate that they pay actors more than a stipend, basically, for expenses. And Equity, because they're a labor union, looked at that and basically said that Equity actors shouldn't be doing that.
What's going to happen?
Well, it looks like to me that they proposed a plan which sort of gives a token to some Equity members who want to do their own shows, produce their own shows, but they can't be a nonprofit, they can't be part of a formal entity, they can't be a company. So an Equity actor who has a lot of money could just produce a show in a theater, rent it, and do a one-off, which is basically a showcase, and there's no protections applied to anyone involved with that production. So that seems a little strange. And there's a membership company rule which says that anyone who's a membership company, like Antius, which does a lot of classical work, and has tons of Equity members, they can continue as they're working with their membership as of now. And they can add no one new. Anyone they add new has to be on Equity contract. And then everyone else, which is really the majority of the scene, has to go onto a plan, onto contract, and pay people minimum wage for rehearsals and for performance. Now, that sounds like...
Minimum wage or Equity minimum?
Minimum wage is the bottom tier. Now, that sounds like, well, that's reasonable, right? Well, it's just that this scene has grown up, and people have been... Lots of theaters and producers have been playing by the rules that existed, and they've built a great, you know, a great vibrant theater scene, at least artistically. Economically, obviously, if it was economically vibrant, they might be able to pay more people. So I got to say, talking to people on both sides, it's really like watching a divorce from a distance of a couple that I love, and I can hear both sides, and I don't know who I can stay friends with, basically. So it's incredibly painful. I think the what it will shake out is that there will be a lot more non-union work. I mean, a lot of these companies, if they want to keep doing what they're doing, as they're doing it, and just express themselves and get on a stage without having to worry about contracts, they'll just do it non-union, as they do
in
Chicago.
There's already a lot of non-union work in LA, isn't there?
There's some, but there's this like storefront scene that's Equity 99 seat, which is not considered non-union. It's considered under an Equity plan.
How is 99 seat different than Showcase in New York?
Well, it's a Showcase code has a really strict cap on number of performances and ticket prices. In Los Angeles, there's a cap on the ticket prices, but the number of performances you can do is something like 80. It's basically like a huge run with an extension. And if you go much beyond that, you're supposed to then go to some sort of contract. So it is like it's basically the logic of it is a Showcase logic. Like actors should be able to get up in front of the industry. Anyway, the plan is basically going away as it is, as we've known it for 30 years. So it's causing a lot of upheaval. I would say that the passions are running high. As again, the divorce comparison came to me because it's like I've been talking to both sides and they both have points, and I'm trying to like, you know. Not like I'm a counselor, but I feel like I want them to work it out.
It's like you're like a divorce counselor for three.
But, you know, I really don't – I don't think they're going to work it out. I think what's going to happen is that Equity will make this proposal, and a lot of these companies will just have to find totally new ways to go. And Equity actors who worked at this level will either have to quit their union or not stop working at this level. That's basically the choice they have.
What if they just impose a strict number of performances on the 99-seat contract, like the Showcase?
Well, there's a lot of what ifs, but Equity, you know, you can propose all you want and have wonderful town halls, but Equity is going to decide what to do. And there will be a referendum of members, but I didn't realize this when I reported the story for a big January piece I did. The referendum is non-binding. In other words, Equity is a representative democracy, not a direct one. So their counselors that they've elected are the ones who are going to decide. Equity members can't vote this up or down directly. You know, they're going to get a referendum and say, we hate this, and if it's not going to matter. As far as I can tell, this is what's going to happen.
I mean, what does that mean for, like, the L.A. small theater scene then? Do you think it's going to kind of mimic small theater scenes, like the off-Broadway scene here, or like the storefront scene in Chicago?
You know, I think there's a little too much. I've heard too many people say L.A. is totally different, but it is totally different. It really is. The difference is that it doesn't have a super robust Broadway or off-Broadway. It's not like a huge commercial theater center. This has been, for better or worse, a large part of the theater activity there. I can't really say what's going to do. I think there's going to be a lot. There are going to be companies that are going to shut down because of this. There are going to be others who just find ways to do it without equity members. And there are going to be a handful, and we'll probably be very, you know, happy and proud of them who managed to do it. But this gets into the issues that we see all the way across the country, where if you're running a large theater with a large overhead, cast sizes start to get smaller. You know, some of these LA companies have put on shows, giant shows, you know, like just like 50 people on stage, you know, stuff that you
like the Flea.
The comparison's often made to the Flea. The Flea's worked it out so that they're considered volunteers there. That's another model that people might pursue in LA, is to try to make a nonprofit. But you know that they're volunteers, but they're also non-union. So that would be like the Flea.
Yeah, they're non-union. Why is this happening now in LA? Did something happen?
That's a great question. I don't know. I think there's been grumbling about it pretty much all the years I've been covering it. Everyone, you know, it's just. Everyone wants to stick around, but they're always grumbling about it. They wish it were better. And there are cases of abuse. There have been cases of abuse where theaters, producers that are spending a huge amount of money on sets, on the rights for the musical rights or whatever.
But not on actors.
There's just not a budget line because that's how the plan is structured. You know, some producers go out of their way to pay more. It's very much, a lot of them operate very much seat of the pants. They operate just enough to stay in business. They get some grants, but the main grant they get is the subsidized, you know, actors' time. You know, but I mean, I should just close by saying actors. The reason it started was equity actors wanted to get on stage without having to worry about all the pay and.
Well, that's the showcase reason.
Right, they wanted to get on stage, and then it became an artistic reason, and a whole scene grew up around it. I think that the balance might have tipped that there's enough equity members who don't want to do that, or who would like to do it but without going bankrupt. You know,
right? Well, I mean that though. This conversation sprung up because of this website that was created. Like, what was it called, Rob?
Reimagine LA Theater.
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is that website.
And those are mostly actors.
That website sprung up. Well, there's a lot of different people on that website, and a lot of people signed on. What's interesting is that. A lot of people are blaming that website for what's happened, but equity was the moves have been in place for a while. They seem to have had this as their agenda. So that Reimagine was actually sort of a response to say, let's really think about this, what we want to do. And then producers formed their own league, the intimate producers. Like, I could go on for hours, but this is a topic dear to my heart, and it's one where I'll be reporting on some more. So
read Rob's piece whenever it comes out.
I'm hoping the week we're taping to have it up, but at least by the time that this podcast is up, there should be some kind of story for me.
Which is today.
What's that?
The podcast is supposed to be up today.
Right, so possibly later than that.
Possibly not when this podcast is up.
So maybe sometime next week, readers.
Watch this space, I would have to say.
Yeah.
But you wrote about it a few months ago. That's not a current story.
Yeah, it was in our January issue. Yeah, I mean, it lays out some of the stakes of the debate. But boy, the specifics are much gnarlier than I thought. So yeah. I'm going to write some more.
Yeah, it's a developing story, and Denver Center Theater Company story. I will be posting it up this week or early next.
All right. So just in other words, keep checking our website
exactly.
for new stories.
And I'll be posting about Parade.
Yes, you're seeing
at Lincoln Center. They're doing a one-night-only concert of Alfred Uri and Jason R. Brown's Parade, and so I'm going to get to do a quick chat with the creative team and some of the cast.
Yes. Sounds
for
good.
Us. So
yes, Susie's a big JRB expert slash scholar, and she will be talking more about last 5 years after my interview with Larissa.
So why don't we go to that?
Yes.
Scintillating interview with Larissa. Take it over.
So what's the costume shop?
The costume shop, actually, Ellen Richards, who's on the board at TCG, she was one of the fantastic people that got that place up and running, because it's right next door to where their new theater is going to be. It's a black box space, but it's a big black box space. It's a storefront, but it's quite large. And so it's flexible use to all kinds of things. And they've had a wonderful partnership with local theater companies in the Bay Area, where they allow them to use that space for little to no cost and extend their runs into a kind of a better known venue.
Yeah, because the Landless, it's from Alta Theater Ensemble. They're like a nomadic kind of theater company. They usually perform in storefronts in Marin County. And so it had a prior run there in a storefront in Marin. And then now it's being moved to San Francisco. So that's exciting. And
yeah, it really is. I mean, their whole thing is, which I was really excited about. This was a commission piece, and it's all about, they call it window shopping for theater, where they use like theater as revitalization of their main street in San Rafael, the main street, which is actually called 4th Street, but it's their, you know, equivalent to Main Street. And so they perform in different empty storefronts, and they never know where they're going to be. It just depends on, you know, who's renting. And we were generously given our space for the past month by Johnny's Donuts, who are going to be expanding into the space. But until then, they let us use it.
Yeah. Were there free donuts involved, or is that not a perk?
For rehearsals, yes. And they actually did. There's a section of where there was like a birthday cake involved, but it ended up being donuts instead.
Wait. So for our readers who don't know what Landless is about, can you give a quick summary? Since you'll probably do it better than I can.
Okay, we'll see. I'm terrible at this. But Landless is a play, like I said, it was commissioned. I knew it was going to be in a storefront. So I said, hey, why fight it? Let's set it in an empty storefront. And so when we enter the play, we're a couple hours before the final liquidation auction of a store that had been the anchor of that, you know, fictional Main Street. It was an 120-year-old store, and the woman who is the direct descendant, you know, from the person who started the store is finally closing due to a myriad of reasons, including the recession, infighting with the business association, with different issues revolving around homelessness, and her Native American associate who was a supporter of a casino coming to town.
And I read that it was kind of inspired by these stories because you interviewed the citizens of Marin County and like storefront owners and Native American elders and the residents. So can you tell me a little bit about like what was that process like for you?
Yeah, it was something. I was actually working with Cornerstone Theater Company at the time, and I was really digging the story circle process and. I've always done a lot of research and interviewing as a playwright, but to have it formalized into actually, you know, gathering stories and trying to put them together into a piece that represents someone else more than my own, you know, vision of something was really cool. So I took it upon myself to do that in San Rafael. I spent 3 days. Alta Theater arranged some meetings with me, but I ended up getting most of my information from people on the street. I was really lucky. The first person I talked to my very first morning was a homeless man who happened to be Native American, a California Native person, and he'd chosen to be homeless for the past 22 years, and he became my guide. And he introduced me to, besides the store owners and those people, introduced me to a whole community that's very much part of San Rafael, but a little harder to access because of their transient nature, and it was a pretty amazing experience. So I would say, you know, the final result ended up maybe weaving in a little more than I needed to. It was interesting because it's hard when you're responsible for other people's stories.
Right.
You know,
right.
I felt like I need to weave in a lot, which now in retrospect, I'm like, eh. But people are responding really well to it. So yes, it works.
Right. Well, they're going through these objects, the two characters in their play, and these objects bring up different stories. And so since it's from all these different people, like how do you integrate that into the one, like these characters' stories?
Yeah, that's the tricky part, right? I kind of distilled the heart of Main Street and the shop owners I talked to down to two characters, the main woman who is auctioning off her store, and then sort of her counterpart who is still holding on but really struggling. And the recession has taken an incredible toll on Main Street and box stores and a mall and, you know, all of that. So I distilled all of my shopkeeper stories down to those two, basically. And then actually there's one monologue from a homeless guy whose father owned a store on Main Street. And so that's kind of how I did that. I filtered through them. And then the homeless and the Native American stories all came through this one young man, Josiah. And then a few of the other stories filtered in. There's other, this particular production was down to four characters playing, I think it's nine roles total. But, you know, it could be done with nine or it could be done with four. But it was really striking. I think, you know, obviously, you know, with me, the Native American story and the struggle for recognition and the fight over casinos just happened in that close to that area. And it got very contentious and difficult. And, you know, those resonated with me very obviously and easily. But I was really surprised at how much the shopkeeper stories really hit me, and these individual shop owners and what they go through and how incredibly personal it is. It's not a business. It's not a franchise. It's their whole life. And they feel like they're not just part of Main Street, but they feel like they are part of your life when you walk into that store. And it really struck me. And I really tried to get that across on how personal it is to these people when you stop coming to their store. It's not just business. It's very personal.
Well, it's personal livelihood. I mean, because you're right, it's not just a franchise. There's no big corporate overlord that's kind of running the whole thing. It's all mom and pop. And I mean, I feel like for me living in New York City, like it's kind of full of these local coffee shops, local food markets, butchers, that kind of thing. But whenever I leave New York City and I go back to California, it's just, you know, like TGI Fridays and Walmart and all of these really like almost bland kind of there's no personal touch left.
No, I hear you. And I think too, you know, this is one lady I talked to who runs a formal dress shop. Mm-hmm. And she's like, you know, I have one customer that, you know, I helped her mother buy her first communion gown. And then we bought her quinceañera gown, and then I bought her prom dresses, and then I was there when she got married, and we picked out her wedding dress. She's like, you know, I've been a part of every important part of this person's life, and, you know, when they stop shopping there because they can get something cheaper or online or whatever, it hurts. I mean, she feels like she was left out of this woman's life.
What were, like, the most interesting stories that didn't make the cut?
Ooh, wow. That's a good question. To think back now. Oh, wow.
Or like one, you know, in particular.
I think, you know, there were definitely too many of the homeless people's stories. I mean, I could have done a whole play on that. I ended up, there's a fantastic chaplain, they call him the homeless chaplain, that works up in San Rafael, and he's a young guy covered in tattoos and piercings. And he's been a real lifeline to a lot of the homeless and transient community there. And so I came to his, what he calls, like, gathering, kind of a church service, if you will, but it's all faith, any faith, whatever, no faith, whatever it is you've got, you're allowed to share. And there's always food involved. And, I met so many people, and the thing I'm always struck with being a playwright is, how much people want to tell their stories and how people are just dying to tell their stories and to be heard. And so there were so many stories I collected from those people that, you know, said their whole play by themselves. I couldn't possibly include them all.
So what's it like now in Marin? Is it kind of almost commercializing? Or are there still these little mom-and-pop shops left? Or is it in this kind of in-between period?
Well, like, San Rafael was considered the working class part of Marin. Probably Novato and San Rafael would be of Marin County. But it is definitely changing fast. You know, their downtown is struggling. Every time I go there, there's more nail salons, you know, and fewer, you know, known store, you know, old established stores. While we were there, I think there were two stores that had been around for 30 to 40 year range that were closing. You know, every year there's more closing because, again, you know, there's box stores. There's a huge complex that opened up right across both the canals, the canal district. There are a lot of, you know, shopping centers, and there's a mall nearby, you know, so it's changing constantly. They also, though, for them in the recession, they lost a tremendous amount of, what was it, the film industry? There used to be two film studios up in Marin, and they're both gone. So a lot of that kind of stuff has left and then took its buying power with it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. It's like malls, like a death of America.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I remember growing up in South Dakota in the little town I was in, when the mall came, Main Street never recovered. I mean, to this day, it's not the same. That was like 30 years ago.
Wait, so tell me more about South Dakota, because I read in your bio that you're formerly a ballet dancer. So how do you go from being a ballet dancer to being a playwright, since, you know, one art form is, you don't talk much
as a dancer. I always tell people it's not a mistake that I don't, that went from a ballet dancer to playwright, where I get to just, I don't actually talk a lot at all. But, and then they're like, you've got to be kidding me, because I talk really fast. I'm working very hard at speaking slowly right now. But yeah, I was a ballet dancer. I was really fortunate. You can see the play about it at Children's Theater Company in a couple of seasons, about how I became a ballet dancer from the middle of South Dakota.
Wait, what's it called?
We don't have a title yet. It was called Fancy Dancer, and now it's been reworked, and right now it's the Untitled Ballet Play. It's going to be a couple seasons from now at Children's Theater Company. But that to tell you how I became a ballet dancer, which is a long story. You know, I got into playwriting because I was here in Los Angeles. You know, I've been thinking a lot about it recently because dancing, I also do choreography, and I'm going to direct my first show this year, and I did some acting last year. I'm doing some acting now. I just got asked to act in another piece this year, and it's just really been thinking, making me think about what made me a theater artist and a theater maker in general. And I've really been thinking a lot about ballet and how much becoming a ballet dancer formed my sense of artistry. It taught me so much about the power of stillness, and that you can hold an entire audience in the palm of your hand and share your soul with them without saying a word and without moving a muscle. And it just taught me about that magic that's theater that you can't get in a movie and you can't get on TV. And I think, you know, really ballet is what inspired me to become a playwright ultimately. I went first through film and TV because I lived in LA and I thought, you know, that's what you do. But I just never really fit there, and it wasn't until I got back to theater for the first time and got in a room. I was telling people, I sat down in my first rehearsal hall, which was at Children's Theater Company of Minneapolis, with Peter Brocious and Melissa Adams, and I was like, oh, okay, this is dancers with furniture. Like, I can do that, you know? Like, this is my world, and I get this, and it makes sense to me. And I mean, ballet, if I hadn't been a dancer, I don't think I could be a playwright, because it taught me how to work independently. It taught me how to be incredibly dedicated and how to work at something alone for years and years and years and years without ever getting it right, and how to fall and fail. And then it also taught me how to work with others, that you can work all by yourself all this time, but then when it comes together, it has to be a perfect collaboration of a group of people. And I think it really all led me to playwriting.
Yeah. I mean, growing up in South Dakota, was there a big performing arts community? Like, how do you, like, it's like very, theater and ballet, like very high, you know, like upscale kind of art. And so, like, where did that come from, I guess?
You know, it's a mix of things. One, of course, you know, as it all is, it came from my family. My parents are both very committed to mostly music as their form, you know, just not as a profession, but as far as their passion and as hobbies, you know, we both were heavily involved in music in school and played instruments and continued to play in their church and played organ and sing choir. And, you know, so music was always very important. You know, there'd always be an opera playing on the radio every weekend. You know, we'd listen to the Met on the radio or something. You know, that was always very important. And watching things on TV, because, you know, things don't come through there often. I do remember when I was like 10-ish, I want to say, this is before we had a theater. We have a theater in town now, but where I grew up in Pierre, South Dakota, we had like a concert series, you know, where, you know, you do these bookings of like Midwest concert booking people. And my dad was on the community concert board, and they brought in a ballet company, and they had to perform in our civic auditorium, which is, you know, like a cafetorium kind of thing, you know, like it's got this little flat stage-ish thing. And, you know, they just roll up the basketball hoops and we sit on bleachers, you know, and folding chairs, and it's freezing cold and there's no dressing rooms. And I can't imagine how horrible it was for these dancers now, you know, like looking back, but it was magic. And, you know, when you're from the middle of nowhere and you've never seen it before, you don't know the difference, you know, and just those few performances, you know, four concerts a year that came through. We had a lot of community theater. We had a really strong arts program in my school, you know, talk about arts education. And you could be in everything, because it's a small town, you could be in everything, you know. So I was in choir and band and theater and ballet, and you could do all of it. And we had a really strong program that supported all of those things. And even though it's on an amateur level, if you start as a kid, as we all know now, you know, from a million studies, if you start as a kid, even on that really amateur level, it makes an art lover for life.
I feel like most people who fell in love with theater initially, it was because like they saw that one thing that kind of turned the, like, it turns the light on in your brain that says, oh, wow, it's like, I want more of this.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and I mean, my girlfriend and I ran the concessions for the community theater in town, and they did like 3 plays a year, you know, just whatever. It was mostly, you know, 1776 and Days of Wine and Roses and, you know, stuff that, you know, it's kind of a staple of community theater sort of plays, but it was live theater going on as I was in a theater. And then I had an aunt in the Twin Cities, and they have fantastic arts there. And so we'd always go to things when we went to the cities to visit her.
And I have no idea how geography works. So is it driving from
San Francisco? Yeah, it's like a 7-hour drive, I want to say, 6-7 hours.
Wow. I'm from California, and so to drive to the next state was 3 hours away. So
yeah, it's a ways. But crazy, like we would, then when I was in high school, my ballet teacher, she'd arrange these trips, and we would drive all, you know, get a bus, and we'd all drive all the way to Minneapolis, 7-8 hours or whatever, see a show, you know, sleep a few hours, and turn around and drive back, you know, it's crazy. But we used to do it all the time, just to get to see something.
Right, so I guess, what was the first thing you saw, you've ever seen?
You know, the first thing I remember professionally, I think, was Children's Theater Company. They did a performance of, what's her name? Horrible girl. Heidi. They did an adaptation of Heidi that I remember seeing as a really, I can just see, you know how as a child, you just see images, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't remember the whole story, but I remember images of it, and that it was really impressive. And it wasn't in their theater, though. At the time, they were performing, they were doing some satellite performing in St. Paul, and that's where we saw it. Mm-hmm. And that's the first thing I remember as a professional production.
And so when you finally got to work with them, was it kind of, oh my God, it's like, I used to drive like 7 hours to see you.
Totally. Well, and if you've ever seen their productions, I mean, you feel that way as a playwright anyway. Their production value is better than many things I've seen on Broadway. I mean, it's incredible. Mm-hmm. They're really doing amazing work there.
Yeah. Well, you produced something with them before, right?
Yes. The Average Family was that was actually my first play. It was commissioned by them. And I had it in my head that you had to have a degree to write plays. I think because my playwrights do have degrees. And because I was a dancer, I didn't, you know, finish college. I was working. And so I thought I couldn't do theater. And then Peter Brocious found me through the Sundance Institute, where I was working on a screenplay. Mm-hmm. And he commissioned my first play, and it got produced there, of all places to have your first play.
Wait. How do you become a playwright without having a master's degree? Like, I feel like you should teach a class about that.
I know. I thought that too, but yeah, I still haven't, like, I don't have, I'd like, I actually, I keep thinking, man, I wish I'd kind of like to do a master's program, but I think you have to do undergrad first, and I'm not willing to do that, so I don't have the time. Yeah, I don't know. I'm really fortunate. You know, I got to teach a workshop this year at, CalArts for their master's program, and it was just so surreal. It's like, wow, I don't know. I kept telling them, you know, I didn't go to school, right? I keep telling everybody this. I should probably shut up, but now everybody knows because I said it 20 times. But you know, I think again, it's from ballet. You know, ballet really taught me how to be disciplined and to learn my craft and to spend a lot of time on my own working and learning my craft. It was definitely really horrifying to have my first production be at a Lord A Theater being reviewed. You know, I'd never written a play before. I didn't know if this was going to work, you know, and that was a little, yeah, horrifying, I guess is the best word, you know, because I didn't have college to try things out. I didn't have a safe space to, and a bunch of advisors and 2 semesters to work it out. And you know what I mean? I just had you know, an audience. And so I feel like, you know, I'm still growing and learning. You know, it's a second career for me, and I've been really blessed that it's been a good career and it's still going. So far, so good. You know, I won like a national award kind of early, so that helped a lot too, I think, kind of pushed me forward.
Where did you learn form from? Or was it from years of just watching children's theater company shows?
You know, I was really fortunate that when I was doing film and TV, I worked in development. So I worked first at Universal Studios, and then I worked for Paramount Studios, and I was a creative executive, which is like the equivalent to a dramaturg in film and television. And I had some really incredible mentors that were like, look, you need to understand story, you know, and movies and how a story is told. And they had me just reading endlessly and working with writers and talking to writers and reading work, you know, several plays a day and reading books about it. And so I just kind of did the same thing with playwriting. You know, I had mentors help me and say, you know, who do I need to be reading? And just, I was constantly reading plays, constantly reading reading work by different types of playwrights, by playwrights I admired, by, you know, playwrights I didn't get at all, and trying to understand it. And, you know, I did a really just reading more. And I honestly spent the first couple years just reading and not going to a lot of theater, just to really get my head away from the attaching to the final product, but sticking with the script itself. And so, yeah, I guess from there. And from ballet, you know, ballet tells a story. You have to learn a lot about storytelling to be a dancer. Mm-hmm. Especially I was a balancing dancer, so we were doing non-story ballets, but I was always putting my own narrative into it and trying to kind of connect a narrative for the audience so that they have something to follow. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, just kind of gave me an innate ability to know how to do that.
Where did you train as a ballet dancer, and where did you dance primarily? Which company?
I started with Atlanta Ballet in Atlanta, Georgia. And then I just met my husband before I went there. And so I moved to Los Angeles, and I ended up dancing with all the ballet companies that came and went in LA. LA's had a rough time with ballet. So we had many ballet companies that came and went. And then as a guest dancer, tried musical theater, did a few things. And then eventually I got 10 years out of it professionally before I had to quit.
What was the reason, can I ask?
I had just injuries. You know, I got 10 years and finally had to, my body was done. Ballet isn't just a career. It's been your identity since you were like, you know, 3. You know, for me, it was 8. I started really late. I didn't start till 8. You know, so it's like,
you're over the hill when you're
everything.
8.
Yeah, right? I know, it's crazy. But it's everything, and you're not allowed to do anything else or be involved in anything else. You are only allowed to be in ballet. And so when you have to stop at such a young age, you know, in your 20s, and find something else to do, you have no idea who you are outside of ballet, you know. And it took a while. There's an amazing organization called Career Transitions for Dancers that gave me a career counselor that I worked with for 2 years to help me make a transition and eventually find writing.
It's like being an athlete, because those kind of professions, like, you need to be young to start, and it dominates most of your early life. And then once you're done, it's like you're over the hill when you're 25.
Exactly. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. But it's great that you're able to still be a storyteller of a different stripe now. What kind of advice do you have for playwrights who want to make a go of this, but can't go to a master's program or doesn't think that that's a feasible option for them?
You know what? I think, honestly, and this is going to sound so cliche, but I think it's not, actually. It's kind of daring. You have to believe it's possible. I'm shocked at how many people are constantly telling playwrights, you can't do this for a living. You can't have this as a career. Or you can't make a living in theater. It's just, that really blows me away. And I believe a lot in you know, self-fulfilling destinies, you know, like if that's what you say. Again, there's a bunch of books that people recommended to me about playwriting, and I opened them up, and it's crazy how many of them were like, oh, this is so awful. Oh, this is so hard. Oh, this, you know, you're going to have a terrible life and you're going to struggle. And I was like, okay, I threw that book away immediately. You know, I think that's the very first step, is you have to believe it. You have to believe that you can do this. You have to believe that you can make a living at it, that you can be good at it, that you can grow. I'm certainly growing all the time. I know that's really, it sounds so silly, but it is the first step. I'm shocked at how much people are told that we can't do this. And yet I know a lot of playwrights who do this for a living, and they're very quiet. We're all very quiet about it because you're not supposed to say that. You're supposed to not say that you can do this as a job. And I don't know why. Somehow we've gotten there. There's some weird thing in the struggle that's, I don't know what they think we get from that, but for some reason, believing we can't do it is better than believing we can. That's sad.
Because there's like that payment structure for playwrights and that there's not a lot of it. So I guess how do you make a living as a playwright, considering commissions aren't very high and royalties usually aren't as high as they would be if you were doing a Broadway show or doing television. So what's the secret ingredient, I guess, to making a...
I think part of it, this sounds crazy, but I think part of it is need. You know, I'm married to an artist. We have tremendous need. We have to pay our bills every month. I cobbled together a million jobs at once. People are always like, oh, you're working on so many things. I'm like, well, if I don't, I can't pay my bills. You know, I have to have five projects going or I can't pay my bills. So you don't get the luxury of, you know, I'm going to work on one play for 2 years. And, you know, you have to be working on 3 to 5 projects at all times. You have to be very flexible and willing to do pretty much anything. It's interesting. I had this job in North Carolina that was like a tourist theater. And I was surprised at it's a really well-paying gig. And I was surprised at the amount of snobbery I got from a lot of playwrights. Like, oh, that's commercial theater. That's tourist theater. I was like...
Like Broadway touring houses? Or
No, it's like it's a big amphitheater. It's an outdoor drama. So it's a big amphitheater, and they commissioned me to write a new show for them. And, you know, those people pay more money than, you know, our nonprofit theaters. I was like, that show just got me through an entire year. And there's a lot of playwrights that were being very snobby about it, and they would never do that. And they wouldn't... I was like, okay, that's fine with me. I just, you know... paid another year of rent off of playwriting, you know, so great. I'm glad you won't do it. I can keep doing those jobs, you know, so I'm willing to do whatever. I've written stuff for Disney theme parks. I haven't gotten one up yet, but I've done some treatments for them. You know, I'm just want to write for people. I don't care who they are. I don't care where they are. I don't care if they're theater goers or if they're a bunch of, you know, there was a busload of French teenage tourists at my show when I got to see it in North Carolina. It was amazing. Like, I got to touch the lives of a busload of French teenage tourists. You know, like, when does that happen? You know, it was so cool. And it was an amazing job. I loved it. I loved being in a theater, this huge amphitheater of people that would never see another play possibly in their life. You know, I'm like, that's an amazing audience to write for. And so you have to just be really willing to be flexible and to take any job. You know, this year I'm going to be... I just had one play produced. I've got another play coming up for Cornerstone. I'm also going to direct a play this year, and I'm going to act in a play. You know, I'm going to do a lot of different things, and then I've got 2 other commissions I'm still finishing out. So then we'll see what happens next year. So this year I get to pay my rent to the end of the year. Next year, I don't know. We'll find out.
What's a show from Cornerstone called?
That one's called Urban Res, R-E-Z.
Oh, whoa.
And it's like an outdoor immersive piece.
Ooh, I love those. When is it happening?
Well, it's Cornerstone, so we don't have a date. In theory, it's happening in October, September, October.
Okay, so just for anyone who's interested, set your Google alert for it.
Exactly. It's part of their hunger cycle. So if you just keep up on their hunger cycle, it'll be there.
Yeah. Wait, for me personally, I'm really curious about this, because when I first made contact with you, and it was because of this piece I was writing about, you know, the arts of color banding together for representation and on advocacy level. And so you have put together like the Native American, I guess, is there a name now, official name now for that?
We don't, and we're moving very slowly.
But it's kind of modeled off the Latino Theater Commons. And so for you as like a Native American playwright and also a woman whose play has been featured on the Kilroy's list, has the topic of representation been something that you feel particularly strongly about? Has it kind of been like a hindrance to your career in a way?
You know, actually, for me, I have to say it's mixed. You know, in some ways, you know, obviously, yeah. Fortunately, we're at a time in our society where people are becoming more aware of who's not represented, right? And so that's been beneficial to me, that I've gotten play commissions several times by theater companies that have said, wow, you know, we've suddenly realized we've never represented a Native American playwright, we've never represented a Native American story, we really want that specifically for our stage, and here I am, you know? So in that way, it's definitely been a benefit. What is hard, though, is then getting my plays produced again. And the number one problem with that is casting. People are afraid of casting. They're afraid they can't find Native performing artists. And that's been constantly a wall I'm slamming against. Even when I say I'm fine with non-ethnic specific casting, you know, with using other ethnicities, they're not suddenly. Even though, you know, I don't know, they'll do Yellowface, King and I, but they won't do a Latina person in my Native play. I'm not sure what that is. I'm still trying to figure that out. But yeah, so we're, you know, it's that's been the number one issue for me is casting and getting people to see beyond it. And I can tell you, I'm contacted constantly for people that are casting stuff out of New York, and they've been told by the New York casting directors there are no Native actors. Like, they just aren't. They don't exist. And I know tons of them, mm-hmm. you know. And so people contact me, and I'm like, yeah, here, let me connect you up with a bunch of people, which is frustrating. I don't know why that persists as a thing, especially here in L.A., where we have Native Voice of the Autry, which is an equity theater company that employs tons of Native actors. They have a 19-person show going right now.
Yeah. Off the rails, yeah. That's also a problem, like, faced by Asian, like, most actors of color. It's like unless you show up specifically for the, you know, for the Native American role or the Asian American role, what have you, like, you won't be getting that call usually.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's so maddening. And yet, you know, they'll cast a white actor as five different ethnicities. You know what I mean? Wow. Okay. Something's clearly still imbalanced here.
Yes. I just recently found this Tumblr called... It's a Tumblr of Caucasian actors playing, being in The King and I, and it's a lot of eyeliner, and I don't know, when I was looking at it, a lot of eyeliner and bronzer as you would, and I was looking at it, and I didn't know whether to laugh or to kind of be really depressed about that. There's enough to, like, fill four pages of a Tumblr account.
Right. Oh gosh. Yeah. I mean, that's the play I'm doing with Cornerstone. It's satirical. And so some of this, the point of it is, I mean, ultimately the, like, philosophical point of it is that I'm trying to equalize theater, audience engagement, and education into, like, three equal partners in this piece. So as you come to the experience, as we're calling it, you may or may not encounter script, and if you don't, it won't matter. You're going to have a fantastic, you may just encounter actual cultural educators, or you may just engage with audience members at some of the satirical booths that I have, or you may engage with some of the scripted characters that are having scenes. Whatever way you go, you're going to have an amazing experience. But the point is that I have several satirical booths about casting and about, you know, portrayals of Native people that I hope are fun and enlightening. We shall see.
Yeah. I mean, at the very least, like, it'll kind of combat that, you know, stereotype that I've heard so much of, which is, like, the Native people don't really exist. Like, they don't, they're not part of the modern American diaspora.
Yeah, totally. I know. And we're not even a part of, like, the past, like, 100 years or so. You know what I mean? Like, it's fascinating to me how much, like, we didn't exist. You know, nothing existed, obviously, before, you know, Columbus. And then after that, we stopped existing sometime in the mid-1800s. We just mm-hmm. disappeared from, you know, the history and the culture and everything. We're just gone. It's amazing to me. Except for a few, like, footnotes of historical moments, which just seem to pop out of nowhere. We've completely been erased.
Yeah. Well, and except when there's skirmishes and wars right. and things like that. It's always negative. And so, and I guess for you, do you ever find, like, do you have this obligation to, you know, be, like, a spokesperson for your culture as the Native American playwright in the slot for this season?
You know what? It's funny, we just had a discussion about this at the TCG board. I'm on the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee. Mm-hmm. And we're just talking about, you know, the importance of making sure when a person of color speaks, they aren't perceived as speaking for the entire, you know, racial population that they happen to be a member of, is to letting people speak as individuals. And Kwame and I were having a talk about this, and I was like, you know, the truth is, though, when you're the only one of very few invited into these rooms, you kind of have, I mean, I feel like there is an obligation. Like, I have to speak for others. Obviously, we all are individuals with completely different points of view and different ways of viewing the world and different choices about theater and art and all of that and completely different cultures. But yet when I'm in, you know, like the TCG boardroom where I'm, you know, very honored to serve, you know, the number of, you know, Native people have been on that board are, I don't know, like two, three maybe. You know, there's not very many of us that have been there. And so that there is definitely an obligation that when I speak, I'm speaking for myself, but I always try to include, you know, have the larger, you know, Native theater community in mind and to make sure that they're being thought of constantly. That it's not like just when I'm sitting there, yes, you know, they're going to see me and my particular personal and artistic choices, but I also want them to remember that I'm just one of many. And that's a constant battle to remember. It's not just Larissa Fasthorse, it's Larissa Fasthorse and an entire Native community that is here and ready and willing and able.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on. How about you?
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Where can people see your work right now?
Well, nice of you to ask. Right now, obviously, my play Landless is still going for a couple more weeks up at the ACT Costume mm-hmm. Shop with Alter Theater, and you can find the information at altertheater.org, and that's theater with an ER. And then I have a reading in New York. Yay, next month. The Lily Awards chose three directors to choose three plays from the Kilroy's list, and Liesl Tommy chose my play, What Would Crazy Horse Do? And so March 16th, they're doing a reading in New York with Liesl Tommy directing of my play. And so you can go to the Lily Awards and reserve a spot. The tickets are free, but you have to do like the whole like reservation thing.
Right. But, and we had two commissions, right? So
yes. So the other one would be Cornerstone Theater Company is coming up next. That will be like sometime, probably October. we're still working out dates. But if you go to their website, Cornerstone Theater Company, and follow The Hunger Cycle, it's part of The Hunger Cycle plays, and it's called Urban Res. And then we're still seasons out for my play at Children's Theater Company, but it's going to be some kind of ballet-themed play. We don't know what it's called yet, but I'm excited about that, too.
I was going to say, because I don't know if you know Young Jean Lee's work. She's like, yeah, and so she did this piece called Untitled Feminist Show that also featured dancing. I mean, there were nude women dancing, but it was dancing and it was wordless. So if you wanted to call Untitled Ballet Play, that would be very avant-garde.
Right. This is probably jumping the gun, but Young Jean actually just asked me to be in her new piece.
Oh my God.
Yes. I know. I'm so excited. I can't tell you. So yeah, she's her next piece is all a Native American cast, and it's going to be a film with a live component, so a hybrid piece.
Oh wow! Is she going to kind of examine you with a microscope?
Apparently, I don't know. I'm excited more than anything just to see her process and see how that goes. So we're just going to get started on that.
I remember talking to Randy, and he says that like 20 years ago there were maybe like a small handful of Native American plays in the repertoire, but now there's hundreds. And so I feel like, is this a good time to be a Native American playwright? Is there a lot of support?
Oh yes. I mean, I was, I'm working on a play, actually a musical right now with Ty Defoe. He's another Native, writer and performer. And, we were just saying how it's amazing. I mean, we get to take a lot for granted because, so many of the playwrights that were the handful back in the day, you know, Bill Yellowrobe, Terry Gomez, Muriel at Spider-Woman, those people had to fight so hard just to be heard. You know, in the 60s and 70s, they fought and fought. And then, you know, Randy and Jean coming up in the 80s, they fought so hard. I mean, they had to have stare down blatant head-on racism just to get a play up, and we get to, like, you know, debate about where we're doing a piece and what form we're doing it in and talk about our contracts, and, you know, that's, we have such a luxury compared to what they dealt with, and yet, you know, we've got a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, where else is it going, you think?
I hope that we can, in the future, be completely integrated into the full seasons and not into a particular month, or to get that one Native American slot. There will be times when there's a call for different types of scripts, and I'll find out, you know, Rihanna Yazzie, a fantastic Native American playwright, got that opportunity, and it'll be like, well, that's it. You know, we hired a Native American, so we're done. Maybe, you know, another 10 years we'll hire another one. As opposed to we hired a fantastic playwright, and you're a playwright we'd like to work with also, and we can work with both because you're not fully defined by your ethnic identity, you're defined as an artist. Mm-hmm. And that would be a really wonderful thing, I think, both for us as artists, but also for the theater community.
So we're back. With just a few quick recommendations of things that we think you should know about, whether it's on stage or in print or online or wherever. Dee, why don't you start out?
Sure. I just have one thing. So this weekend, Susie and I will be seeing The Iceman Cometh with Brian Dehaney and Nathan Lane at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. She's my date for Valentine's Day. It's gonna be awesome.
The Iceman Valentine.
We're getting daggers before.
Yes, right. And booze during. But okay. Anyhow, it was originally produced at the Goodman, and you know that, and Bam and Scott have been transferred over to New York City. Anyhow, I'm not recommending that show because I haven't seen it. But I am recommending this article that was written by Time Out Chicago theater editor Chris Vier, where he took Nathan Lane and Brian Dehaney out to a bar and got them drunk. And then Brian Dehaney called Jessica Lange a bitch. It's like the most genius Q&A I've ever read. And kind of really inspiring. So,
if you're a journalist, you'll especially love it because there's shout-outs to publicists trying to cut off interviews and Brian Dehaney talking back.
Nice, nice. Yeah, I still haven't read it because I wrote a big piece about it for another publication, and I didn't want to be influenced, and I still haven't gotten around to reading it. I'm going to see Iceman on Sunday.
Yeah.
Well, I saw it when it was in Chicago, and I'm not a big Eugene O'Neill fan, but I can say that this is a great production. But it's 5 hours long.
Yeah, so I'm flying out to Southern California the next day, so I don't know how that's going to work out, but...
Wow, that's a great way to... So you're going to see Iceman then fly to California. I think that is the doctor's orders.
Exactly.
That's exactly what you need.
I'm going to need that.
What do you recommend, Rob?
Yeah, mine's actually related to that. Just one correction. Scott Rudin has the rights to a commercial production in L.A., but he didn't actually bring this to BAM. So it's just a BAM Goodman thing.
Wait, but on... For every billboard
it's
I've
with,
seen,
it's with under... the it's with his permission. It's a complicated thing. Anyway, you don't need to know about that.
Yeah.
Anyway, he didn't bring it.
I'm gonna cut that out.
he allowed it to be brought. He still has an option on it. Basically, mine is a related thing, and I know this is just going back to a story we did a couple weeks ago. But if you haven't read Tony Kushner's piece about the genius of O'Neill, it is one of the best essays I've read by a playwright about another playwright, pretty much ever. I just think. It was helpful to me because, like Susie, I've not been an O'Neill person, and I had a long talk with Bob Falls about it, the director of this production, and
who's done
a lot of O'Neill.
He
thinks he's the American Shakespeare. But if you talk to him a little bit, he'll say he's more like Aeschylus, which I think is probably closer to true. I mean, I had to rifle through my memory to remember. I have not seen a lot of the. I have never seen Long Day's Journey on stage.
I've never seen Long Day's Journey either.
And I had never seen Iceman until I got a chance to look at a rehearsal of it. And I think O'Neill is definitely someone you at least have to reckon with as an American playwright. And Kushner's essay does it as well as anybody. Basically, if you just want to hear the case for O'Neill, if you need to have that made, and if it makes you more interested in some of the work he did and how he did it, I'll just say – one of the things I liked most about the essay is that he points out that I can't think of any other playwright or artist for that matter who did his best plays last. And not just his best plays, but plays that are so much better than the ones he started with. It just kind of goes against this idea that, you know, it's sort of the rock and roll hipster idea that like your best, your first album, your second album, your early work is your most representative. Well, in O'Neill's case, it just took him his whole life to get to the play about him, about his family, which is long to his journey, and also Iceman, which is sort of a play about America and the universe and existential. Iceman makes an interesting sort of counterpoise to Waiting for Godot as sort of one of these mid-century plays that's sort of like about everything, and it's you have to reckon with that play. Anyway, that's my long-winded recommendation. Read the Kushner. He says it a lot better than I do.
And I'm going to recommend this weekend is the debut of director Richard LeGravenis's adaptation of Jason Robert Brown's musical The Last 5 Years, starring Anna Kendrick and Jeremy Jordan. I've had the pleasure of seeing the film twice already, and it's really fun. I mean, it's a really fun movie. It stays very true to the musical and to the structure of the stage show. If you don't know the stage show, it's about a 5-year relationship. And she tells the story backwards, and he tells the story forwards, and they meet in the middle at their wedding. On stage, it's mostly solo songs, but in the movie, the two characters are in each of the scenes, which is kind of fun. There's a little added dialogue, but not a lot, just some stuff to set up context. It's mostly a sung-through show like it is on stage. It's fun to see the characters together. You actually get to see them fall in love as opposed to tell you about how they fell in love. Anna and Jeremy are really great on screen, and it's premieres in theaters on Friday. I think it only is going to be in theaters in New York and LA and maybe Canada, but it's also going to be on demand and on iTunes, and the soundtrack is available, which is essentially the whole show if you just want to listen to it. So
yeah, I've never actually seen it. I've just listened to the cast album and the soundtrack a lot, but I feel like I haven't. It's like I feel like I know it pretty well.
It's one of those shows that kind of defined a generation of young people who loved musical theater. It kind of people who were getting into contemporary musicals kind of post Rent kind of became obsessed with the 2002 off-Broadway recording with Norbert Leo Butz and Cher Renee Scott. And it kind of was this iconic pop score that people are like changing the face of musical theater. And it really, I mean, Jason Robert Brown, who, you know, won a Tony for Parade, which is going to be at Lincoln Center on Monday for One and Only Concert, also with Jeremy Jordan, who's in the movie, and also like things like Bridges of Madison County, where he won more Tonys. He's definitely, you know, won awards for other works, but I think people most identify him with The Last 5 Years. And if you're in New York City, I'm going to be doing talkbacks with Jason R. Brown and Richard LeGravenis on Friday and Sunday at Village East Cinemas, so come by.
Nice. Nice. Sounds good. I think that wraps up another blockbuster edition of Off Script. Thanks for listening.